Conference number 24, 4 p.m., September 28, 1985. Father Hugo.
Opened it, and it was a puzzle. And they were curious at how it worked. And so they began to work the puzzle. And then the other one got into it. And then both started fussing over the puzzle. And then the chauffeur came in. They were getting impatient at the wedding, and they sent the father, the bride, came in a chauffeured car, and the chauffeur came up, and he got involved in the puzzle. And then a little while later, the father came up, and he got involved in the puzzle. And the end of it was there was no wedding, and Oliver lost the bride and the job, both. That's an example of a good example of an attachment, what an attachment will do. We're talking about you, Ed. And okay. Did you get those papers?
You have pretty good. I can't.
Okay. We'll give them to you this evening. All right, let's pray. We'll take a prayer that we indicated the other day. It's a beautiful daily prayer for the will of God. Lead kindly light, Cardinal Newman. Lead kindly light amid the encircling gloom. Lead thou me on. The night is dark and I am far from home. Lead thou me on. I do not ask to see the distant seen. One step enough for me. Lead thou me on o'er moor and fen, o'er crag and torrent, until the night is gone. Lead thou me on, lead thou me on, one step enough for me. So I recommend that prayer to you. One step enough for me. We seek God's will step by step. Well, now we'll go on, and we'll have a conference this evening, the day of the Lord, but this is the penultimate conference, next to the last, the will of God's good pleasure. I want to give you some more passages from Scripture on this, because it's fruitful meditation, and you may be able to help others in your ministry, in your visiting, and in your reading, and in your group prayers. These are beautiful passages to reflect on, and I think some of them are neglected. Maybe not as much as that one on the pruning. It just seems to be lost for the most part, even in books on suffering. But it's the most perfect of them all, because it teaches us how to handle the most difficult of all sufferings, injustice, whenever the innocent suffer. Now, I pointed out to you that in the case of the express will, we practice the virtue of obedience. In meeting the will of God's good pleasure, that is, the indiscriminate events of life, we practice the self-abandonment, the virtue of self-abandonment to divine providence, seeking for the sacrament of the moment. Now, often people speak of resignation. I even noticed in a book that we read that the author spoke several times of resignation. Now, resignation is not a Christian virtue. Resignation is a natural virtue, a pagan virtue, a stoic virtue. It accepts things with a stiff upper lip, with your chin out, as a sort of, these things are a fate that we're doomed to. That's resignation. Now, that is not a Christian virtue at all. It's stoicism. And we can do it. We can flex our muscles and stick out our chin. The great teacher of stoicism was Epictetus, a Roman slave who had certainly enough reason to suffer. And here's a little story about Epictetus to tell you what it is. It's from a biographical introduction into the discourses of Epictetus, I guess that's pronounced, And Epictetus was permanently lame by his master. And it happened this way. When his master was twisting his leg, it is said, Epictetus only smiled, and noted calmly, "You'll break that." And the master kept twisting it, and he broke it. And Epictetus said, "I told you so." That's the Stoic. That's resignation. It's courageous. It's the courage of the pagan. I read the other day, the news last week, the sinking of the Titanic was in the news, and it was a vivid description of the sinking of the Titanic in the Time magazine, which I read. And whenever the time came for the sinking, and they were unprepared, they had more than 2,000 passengers and only 1,000 capacity for 1,000 lifeboats. And according to the rule, women and children first. The women were given the lifeboats and set off, and the men were left to die. Only one woman stayed with her husband. She was the wife of a millionaire, a merchant in New York. She said, "We've lived together. We've been through many things together. We'll do this together." But the others went down, and I guess, I don't know whether it's laughable or real courage. They went and they dressed in full dress and stood, as it were, at attention, and they went down in full dress. I guess it was courageous, but it seems pitiable, you see. It seems to me just pitiable. But it's Stoicism. Now, we often hear people, Catholics, talking about resignation, and resignation is Stoicism. I see it even in Catholic books. It is not a Christian virtue. Even Teilhard de Chardin, he knew nothing other than resignation. His mind was closed off to this self-abandonment, although the Jesuit who wrote that the priest who wrote that self-abandonment, Divine Father, was this Jesuit, one of his colleagues. So, don't believe that resignation is a Christian virtue. It's a poor substitute for people who do not know of the virtue of self-abandonment. Now, that's one thing I wish to point out to you. Another thing I wish to point out to you, and this is critically important, and it's often neglected even in the books that talk about self-abandonment, these two virtues, obedience to the express will and self-abandonment to the will of good pleasure, must be practiced together, in tandem, one after the other. And always, the express will of God is practiced first. Then, only whenever we've done that, can we practice self-abandonment. Now, let me give you an example. A person gets ill. It might be very ill. He might have a stroke. What should he do? Practice self-abandonment? No. Send for a doctor. That's the express will. Thou shalt not kill. Take care of your health. We must do everything we can to fight off the evil. We're talking about different kinds of evils here, moral evil, injuries, and physical evils. Our duty is to do everything we can within the limits of our power to fight it off. And then, if we find that the sickness is persistent and we cannot handle it, then we practice self-abandonment. Meanwhile, we can practice a sort of a relative self-abandonment to the pains and the inconveniences of the sickness we have, but underneath, we're pushing to get better. Now, that's true. That's the way it has to be done. That's what I mean in tandem. First, the express will. The same way with injustice. We must first try to remove the injustice. We have a duty to remove the injustice. There's no use shrugging your shoulders and saying, "I can't do anything about that." You must do what you can. We must not be resigned to injustice. It's our duty to fight injustice. Holiness and justice requires us to do that. Then if we can do nothing, you see, Archbishop Romero did his best to fight without weapons, a nonviolent fight, for the church and for his people. He didn't say, well, we just have to put up with this violence and this murder. He did everything he could. He tried to pressure the government and the soldiers and everything and preached. And then we can practice self-abandonment. Meanwhile, of course, while people were dying in their deaths, they can practice this self-abandonment when they can't do anything else. But we have to practice these virtues in tandem, and always, always the express will first. Otherwise, you see what would happen? We would be fatalists. And this is the danger even of a book like the one I recommended to you, The Sacrament of the Moment by Kitty Muggeridge. It is not safe reading unless you know about the express will of God. It is dangerous to put out books that advocate self-abandonment without construction on obedience to the express will of God. That would be fatalism. You see, this is what happens when we read randomly. Father De Cazaud was a chaplain and a spiritual director for contemplative nuns. And he could presuppose that they had this knowledge to take care of themselves and to take care of the express will of God. But if a person picks up this book without that previous knowledge, then if they do get sick or they fall under some injustice, they say, well, that's God's will. I'll abandon myself. But that is not God's will. It is not God's will. God's will is for us to fight evil wherever and whenever we can. That's God's will. Then we abandon ourselves. Now, this is very, very important. And it's a very great loss. And I feel that this is happens today when people read those books. There's only one spiritual life and one set of principles, but there's different stages of that spiritual life, and we have to meet each stage as it comes. If I have a friend who is an oculist, and I watch him remove a cataract from someone's eye, and then let us say another friend comes and visits me and says, I have a cataract, I'm going to have to be removed. And I say, oh, don't bother, I've got a knife here, and I just watch the doctor do it, let me do it. See? There are certain points in the spiritual life that we need one kind of treatment, and points we that doesn't sufficient. So we need, first of all, the express will. And a book that tells us about self-abandonment is like the person that says, well, let me cut the cataract out of your eye. I'll show you how to do it. It doesn't work that way. So these are cautions. But and St. Francis de Sales, see, he didn't do it wrong. He did it right. He put them both together. He has one whole book on the express will of God and one whole book on the will of self-abandonment. He was the saint. But see, the secondary writers forget that, and they're anxious to help someone, no doubt, but they don't take the necessary cautions. Just like you can buy a machine or a tool and they'll cautions on it, handling of it. You know, this is an electrical appliance and has to be used with caution. So right here, this the will of God's good pleasure is an electrical appliance that has to be used with some caution. Now those are what I wanted to say. Take these two together. That's why I'm giving them to you together. I could have talked about obedience earlier in retreat because it's a basic virtue. But I want you to see it here in this proper place so that you practice these virtues together. I don't want to educate Stoics and fatalists. Well, now let's continue with the will of God's good pleasure, with that understanding. And I want to give you a few other texts. Let me give you another one that illustrates a sort of a variant point on it. This is a little story. It's told by a modern Catholic woman, a short story that I read in a book. I used to read her mother. Her mother was a notable writer. But this daughter, I don't think she's quite as well known or as famous as her mother. The mother was Alice Meynell. And she was quite a fine English Catholic writer in the early part of this century. Well, her daughter, Viola, wrote this story. It's called Kissing the Rod. Now, she tells it better than I. It's a story about a young man who goes to a doctor's office, and he's something wrong with his leg. He's twisted or crippled some way, and the doctor puts him on the table, and he begins to manipulate it. And it's very painful. And the young man protests, but inwardly. He is protesting, and the doctor is manipulating his leg and continuing his pain. And I won't say the young man is cursing. If he is, Viola doesn't quote the curses, but he's protesting inwardly. He's saying, how cruel he is. How mean. He's a devil. How can he do this to a fellow human being? What kind of a man is he? What's his background? How did I ever get in here? Please. This is all his inward struggle. And this continues for a while. The doctor continues to manipulate the leg. And then that's Act 1. Act 2, we see the young man at the front door with his street clothing on now and talking to the doctor. And he said, "Doctor, how can I ever thank you for what you have done for me? I just don't understand how a professional man like you should love your fellow man so much as to take all that trouble with me." You see, even whenever we do positive things, working, we have obstacles. And we have to be able to see these, too, as a pruning, as a providential, to see them as the will of God. We wonder, why did God do this to me? I'm trying to do a good day's work, or I'm trying to support my family, or I'm trying to do a good job for the boss. See, and that's kissing the rod. So the young man at the end kisses the rod that struck him. And that's what we have to learn to do. Kiss the rod. Realize that hidden they are a benefit to us. They are helping us. And any kind of discipline that makes us grow is helping us, although it is painful. When I had these fingers first, I never knew that you could be tortured with your fingers. Whenever I read of torture going on in prison, I thought, vastly otherwise, but that the fingers could torture you. So, but these therapists there, I called it the Inquisition shop whenever I would go there. And that these were the instruments they used there. One of them I called the rack, that they pulled your fingers and forced them into position. I don't know whether they liked that or not, and I was serious about it, all right. Jokingly serious, that's what it was. It was very, very painful. I had no idea that one could suffer that much with his fingers. Thank goodness it's over. I'm not suffering now. But it can be. So we have to accept this for cure and for growth, these things. This is God's way. And instead of complaining about it, I'm thinking especially of the difficulties inherent in our work, the obstacles in our work. Maybe obstacles with people, but maybe obstacles right inherent in the work, and we complain and stamp our feet about these difficulties. This is part of our discipline, part of our growth. We can see this, too, as providential, as a supreme dominion of God, educating us and making us grow spiritually. Well, now I'm ready to give you a couple more texts. I have a few more illustrations. They're good illustrate teaching children, I think, teaching your children, teaching anyone. Here's one little story that I picked up. Once upon a time, a king owned a great, beautiful diamond. It had no peer in the world, and he was quite proud of it. But one day, it was accidentally scratched. The king called in all the diamond cutters in the kingdom, but all said there was nothing they could do to remove that scratch. Later, a great gem cutter arrived in the capital and said that he could make the diamond look even more beautiful than it had before the accident. With great care, he engraved a delicate rosebud around the imperfection and made the scratch its stem. So you see, God can take something that looks like a fatal wound and turn it into something beautiful. The stem is what is that through which the sap ascends into the plant. And the suffering is the way that God gives us the grace that he wants to give us to sanctify us. So there are many stories like that. I'm not going to try to tell you them all. I want to give you a couple more texts, and especially one text. Another illustration is, and this is taken right from the Bible. First of all, it's in the Old Testament, the Book of Wisdom. And then St. Peter, I guess he picked it up there, and he brings it into the New Testament. And you'll find it, we have two letters of St. Peter. You'll find it in the first letter of St. Peter. And it's a beautiful example. It's in our lectionary for the funeral masses, and I often use it for our elderly sisters over here whenever they pass away. I think it describes their situation. I think it describes us all, but I think it seems that some of these sisters live so long, they may not have any violent sufferings as they approach death, but they're wearing away, and suffering in that respect. So here is what the author of Wisdom compares it to: a jeweler who refines gold with fire. Gold is refined by fire, and we are refined by the fire of suffering. There is cause for rejoicing here. You know, oddly, this first letter of St. Peter is a baptismal homily. It was undoubtedly a homily preached by St. Peter in Rome, and it was taken down, and it's become the first letter of St. Peter. And whenever you read it, you'll be surprised that so much of it is about suffering. You would think that he would have a happier frame of mind on the occasion of a baptism and speak about pleasant things. But you see, they were baptizing people in the day when they were being persecuted. Christians were being persecuted. And the preparation of a new Christian had to be not just to have a big celebration, but to be ready for suffering. And so that thought runs all through this first letter of St. Peter. There is cause for rejoicing here. He speaks of these sufferings, and he says we should rejoice. You may for a time have to suffer the distress of many trials, but this is so that your faith, which is more precious than the passing splendor of far-tried gold, may, by its genuineness, lead to praise, glory, and honor when Jesus Christ appears. Far-tried gold. So God is refining us, and he refines us by fire, the fire of suffering, the fire of distress, the fire of pain. And we will be refined. And I think that we can see that in many of these old sisters and many old people generally. They have been greatly refined by suffering. There's a sweetness about them and a mellowness which they didn't have before. And they've done this all in faith. You know, accepting it as God's will, accepting it, sharing in the sufferings of Christ, and they've improved even their dispositions and their lovableness here. And so this is what St. Peter means. And he comes back to that theme later. Then he has another powerful passage in the third chapter, I think, or second chapter. And he's speaking here, he picks out the slaves. As I mentioned, they didn't try to end slavery then. They didn't know how to do it. We saw how St. Paul opposed it, but he went at the elimination of slavery very indirectly by applying the leaven of the gospel to Philemon. St. Peter is standing before a group of Christians. Most of them were slaves, and they want to know what to do in this present condition. And he says, "You household slaves, obey your masters with all deference. Not only the good and the reasonable ones, but even those who are harsh." Now, that's pretty hard advice to give. You'd think he'd say, "Well, now we don't approve of that." And But he doesn't. He knows it's inevitable that he can't correct slavery, so he obey even those who are harsh. When a man can suffer injustice and endure hardship through his awareness of God's presence, this is the work of grace in him. This is the only way he can do it. Stoicism is of no value. It has to be a work of grace. If you do wrong and you get beaten for that, can you claim any credit for that? You deserve that. But if you put up with suffering for doing what is right, this is acceptable in the eyes of God. And now, here's the remarkable statement. Unto this you were called. This is your vocation as Christians. That's strong. That's terrific. How can he say such a thing? Unto this you were called, because Christ suffered for you in just this way. He suffered unjustly and left you an example to have you follow in his footsteps. St. Peter wasn't just talking off the top of his head. He would suffer and die unjustly too. He did no wrong. No deceit was found in his mouth. When he was insulted, he did not return the insult. When he was made to suffer, he did not counter with threats. When he was made, instead, he delivered himself up to the one, capital O, who judges justly. In his own body, he brought your sins to the cross, so that all of us are now dead to sin and can live in accord with God's will. See, it's a beautiful passage. Unto this you are called. That's a powerful passage, to suffer unjustly. And they're the kind of sufferings that we hate the most. And as I said, we have to fight against the injustice, whether it's ourselves or others. But whenever it comes, we should also receive it in this spirit, because Christ suffered unjustly too. He didn't like it, and he didn't approve it. He was fighting these men who caused it, but he was fighting them with his weapons, the weapons of the Spirit, and until the end. But then he accepted it. So that's another passage to watch. The main passage I want you to look at is in the letter to the Hebrews, the last of the letters. It used to be, it's really not a letter of St. Paul, but it was written by probably a disciple of St. Paul. And it has been attributed by some people to St. Paul. It uses his language. And he's talking about suffering. It's a beautiful letter, and I don't think it's a letter, part of the New Testament, which was often read. But it's a very beautiful letter. The first part of it is all doctrinal. He talks about the high priesthood of Christ and Christ's sacrifice. There, it's the only place in the New Testament where Jesus is called a priest. And it's important for that reason. And it shows that he's offered a cosmic sacrifice for the whole world. You see, if you look in the Gospels, they never use words like sacrifice, except referring to the sacrifices of the old law. They don't call Christ's death a sacrifice. They don't use that kind of language. And so sometimes some of our opponents will say that's not true, that the Eucharist is not a sacrifice because Christ didn't call it a sacrifice. But here the Eucharist, the letter to the Hebrews does. It's the one exception. But what the writer of the Hebrews is doing, he's trying to console. We don't know who the people were, who the Hebrews were, except that they were under persecution. They were a group of Jewish converts who were suffering persecution, and they were threatening or in danger of giving in, of apostatizing. And the author is trying to prevent them from leaving Christianity because of this bitter suffering that they're undergoing. So he uses the example of Christ and shows how he suffered. And then he goes back and he rehearses for them, since they were Jews, all the history of the saints of the Old Testament. And he shows how they suffered. Even in the Old Testament, they expected to suffer. Even the just suffered, like Abraham. And he goes down through. them, and that they suffered. And Job is especially notable, but there are many notable examples in the Old Testament, despite the common statement to the contrary. And Hebrews points them all out. And then when he does all that, now he's ready for the practical part of his letter. And that's the most important part. And it's interesting that in our liturgy, the first part of the letter to the Hebrews is usually what we read because it has a direct reference to the Eucharist and to Christ's sacrifice. And this last part is sometimes neglected, but it has it's personal, and it's to help them in their sufferings and their persecution. He does this he enumerates, talks about Christ and the saints of the Old Testament to show them how they should act. And now he puts it here in chapter 12. He puts it together for them. So I'm skipping to chapter 12. Someday, maybe whenever you're in your meditating mood, you can read the others slowly and carefully. Therefore, he says, since we, for our part, are surrounded by this great cloud of witnesses, all the saints of the Old Testament, headed by Jesus Christ, let us lay aside every encumbrance of sin which clings to us and persevere in running the race which is set before us. Let's pull ourselves together, fellows, and get going. Don't be falling apart. Let us keep our eyes fixed on Jesus. There's our leader. Let us keep our eyes fixed on Jesus, who the author and the perfecter of our faith. That's an important statement in the Scriptures. We don't usually think of Jesus as a man of faith. We believe he had a more intimate knowledge of God, but he is the author of faith and the perfecter of our faith. And therefore, or in some translations, says he's the pioneer, and I like that word. He goes before us, showing us the way of faith. So look on Jesus, the author and the pioneer of our faith. And here's another important statement that sometimes is fully waxed up. For the sake of the joy set before him, he endured the cross, heedless of the shame. Now it doesn't say he got joy out of the shame. He doesn't say he got joy out of the pain. He doesn't say he embraced the cross with affection. He says, for the joy set before him. What was that joy? The joy of entering to the Father's glory. The joy of glorifying the Father. The joy of drawing us into the glory of the Father with himself. That was his joy. And he endured the pain. He put up with it. It wasn't stoical. It was for the love, out of love, out of his knowledge of God's will. I won't say out of his faith, but out of his knowledge, his vision of God's purpose, his knowledge of God's design, and his love for the Father, he endured it. But he suffered on the cross. Some of the pious books and prayers are out of order in this respect. They have Jesus hugging the cross and kissing it as though it were a bride. You know, it's not that way. And I don't think we should misrepresent it. Maybe it's meant well, that maybe they mean it this way, but they don't say it this way. For the joy set before him, he endured the cross. It was painful to him, cruel and horrible, the most violent and shameful kind of death that a man could suffer. Heedless of the shame, now he has taken his seat at the right hand of the throne of God. You see, he died and now he rose again. He's in heaven. Remember, says Hebrews, how he endured again, the opposition of sinners. Hence do not you grow despondent or abandon the struggle. He did not abandon the struggle. Now neither should you abandon the struggle. Hence do not grow despondent or abandon your struggle. In your fight against sin, you have not yet resisted to the point of shedding blood. He did. You have not shed blood. You suffered a lot, but you have not shed blood. Moreover, and now here's the climactic argument. Although those are terrific themselves, this is a real package of magnificent teaching and theology in suffering. Moreover, have you forgotten the encouraging words which was addressed to you in olden times as sons? Now that word is important here too. Remember we said we departed somewhat from that use of the word sons. We've been speaking a good bit of ourselves as the bride of Christ and joined to him in a nuptial union. But we don't abandon the image of the sons. That's a special kind of love too, and it has its value. And it teaches something here that's very important. Sometime he's going to quote, for example, here's what it says. My sons, do not disdain, this is from the book of Proverbs in the Old Testament, do not disdain the discipline of the Lord, nor lose heart when he reproves you. For whom the Lord loves, he chastises, and he scourges every son that he receives. Whom the Lord loves, he chastises. That's often quoted sort of jokingly, facetiously, because, you see, it runs contrary to common sense. Whenever we love anyone, we don't chastise them. Especially if you think in terms of marital love, I guess there are wife beatings and murders, I know, but as a typical love, we think of them rather fondling one another and embracing one another and helping one another and even spoiling one another. But in the case of sons and children, they do have to be disciplined by the Lord. You notice he uses the word discipline. He doesn't say punished. There's an element of punishment in it, but his purpose is discipline. My sons, do not disdain the discipline of the Lord, nor lose heart when he reproves you. For whom the Lord loves, he disciplines. Whom the Lord loves, he disciplines. Now that's exactly parallel to our case here. It is the loving parent who disciplines their children. That the permissive parent does not really love. The permissive parent lets the child grow up wild, lets it do anything it wants to do, and for the time being, why, the parents may profit by that, they're not bothered, but in the end, they're going to suffer, everybody's going to suffer by this completely savage, undisciplined child as he grows or she grows into adulthood. So, endure your trials, therefore, as the discipline of the Lord, who deals with you as his sons. Well, we usually think of the father punishing the son rather than the daughter. Maybe mother punishes the daughter. I don't know. I know my father did the punishing, and I learned it that way. Wait till your father comes home. For what son is there whom his father does not discipline? Whom his loving father does not discipline. Now, I'm sure that I stamped my feet and kicked and screamed just like any other little boy. But that's part of it. What son is there whom his father does not discipline? If you do not know, now here's another remarkable statement. If you do not know the discipline of sons, you are not sons, you are bastards. You are not truly the sons of God. You're not truly the children of God. God is not bothering about you. So true is it that God disciplines those whom he loves, that this disciplining is a very sign of his love. He's taking pains with you. Why? Well, he'll tell us. Now, if we respected our earthly fathers who corrected us, should we not all the more submit to the Father of spirits and live? Expected from our earthly fathers, shouldn't we expect it from God? They disciplined us for, as seemed right to them, for a short span of years to prepare us for the short span of our mortal life on earth. Our fathers did. But God does so for our true profit. Now watch the purpose of it all. that we may share in His holiness. Doesn't say in punishment. He even abandons, in other words, this one, to share in His holiness. This is God's way of making us grow into holiness. Now he goes on, at the time it is ministered, all discipline seems a cause for grief. The little boy jumps and howls, screams. I guess little girls do too. But later it brings forth the most peaceable fruit of peace and justice to those who are trained in its school, a school of training, not a school of punishment. It brings peace and justice. Now remember, justice is a synonym for holiness. So this is the second time he said that. For peace, inward peace, and peace with others, because all these ugly traits are kind of, a parent looks and sees a beautiful, lovely child, sweet child, but still has ugly little traits in it. They have to be removed if that child is going to be grow up to be a man, a truly a human being, a true Christian, or a woman. You can't acquiesce in these ugly little characteristics, these ugly little actions of the child. So he disciplines the child to get rid of them. All discipline seems the cause of grief and not for joy. But later it brings forth the fruit of peace and justice, holiness, to those who are trained in its school. So, he says, strengthen your drooping hands. Pull yourself together. Lift your weak knees. Make straight the path you walk. Walk straight ahead, that your halting limbs may not be dislocated, but healed. This is the way to have them healed. Walk straight ahead. Again, he closes this little passage beautifully with, strive for peace with all men, and for that holiness without which no one can see the Lord. Without which no one can see the Lord. That is a tremendously important statement. Without holiness, no one can see God. We must go through this process. We must be sent to enter the kingdom of God. We are not just going to rush in there in our casual as we please. We must be transformed. We must be sent to enter the presence of God. Without that transformation is worked in us by the quality of holiness. Without holiness, no one can see God. It's really something to think about. And this is the reason for the whole discipline of God. Cardinal Newman, one of his great sermons, fastens on this text. And he says it sounds like the author ended that this disciplining, the suffering is sort of built into the structure of the universe by the Father, so that he will enable all to suffer and to become holy. And just as grace is universal, so is suffering universal. And undoubtedly, many people who are not within the church discover this. Then we discover it independently of Christianity. He refused to make others suffer. He sought more and more to suffer himself for others. He made that his philosophy. Suffer for others. Don't try revenge or anything like that. And so God's grace is everywhere, and so some of the pagans learn this. And many Christians don't know anything about it and don't bother about it. But this is good and this is important. So keep that text in mind too, in regard to suffering. Now I want to close this, and we'll do it by coming to the example that Hebrews points before,
There are many other Old Testament stories. One of the most beautiful is the story of Joseph. He was a model and a type of Christ, and he was sold into slavery by his brothers. And afterwards, he became the high official in Egypt and had mastery over all the wealth and the food in a time of famine, as we recall in the Bible history. And at this point, the brothers came to him for help because they were caught in this famine. And they went down to Egypt for food, and they had to go to Joseph.